Hey there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and a guest, Dr. John Norton. How are you doing, Dr. Norton?
Doing great.
It's been a while since I talked about having you on the show on the microphone like probably 6 months ago.
Really?
Because you were getting ready to publish this book here. And as listeners can tell, today we have a guest because we're going to do one of these special episodes that we've been talking about. We've been doing a lot of Q&A episodes. But what we're going to do today is actually talk about a book that's been published at the 1517 Publishing House. It's called Killing Physicians. And you're the author of this book. And it has a lot to do with, it's about Shakespeare, but it's also about Reformation theology. And so that kind of crosses over with what we do, talking about Reformation stuff. And we've never talked about Shakespeare on the show. So I think, it's a new item for listeners to get on something kind of interesting, an interesting cross for the show today. As always, you can download the show on your computer via our website, thinkingfellows.com. You can listen to it live there. You can listen to it on your favorite podcasting apps. I typically, since the iTunes podcasting app has really taken a dive for the worst since the latest update, I would suggest something.
Is that even possible?
Yeah, it's pretty bad now, which is sad because I think like 80% of our listeners get it through the iTunes podcasting app.
You know, the funny thing is, as much as I would say I hate it, it's the only one I can figure out like how to get on my phone because I think it comes.
Yeah, it's standard, which
comes
is why I'm
loaded on my phone probably.
Yep.
So it's the one I use, but I really don't like it.
Yeah, it's really not good. So there's a couple alternatives that I like to support. One's called Overcast. You've probably heard me say that a bunch of times on the show. And it's got a lot of good features. Like you can multiply the speed that the podcast is going. So if you're out of time, you can listen to it. I think all the way up at an insane like 3x speed, which I don't know how you would.
So Chipmunks, isn't it?
Yeah,
Chipmunks
that's right.
Version. Yeah.
So you wouldn't know what's going on, but you can do those types of things. They have a car mixing feature where you hit this button and it helps you overcome the noise of the road while you're listening to it. It tries to lift the bass levels.
What if you have a really nice car that's really quiet?
Well, then you don't need that, probably. Yeah, if you're driving a Tesla out there, you're probably okay.
But it's good in, like, Adam's Jeep.
Correct, or my Subaru, you know, yeah. where they skimp out on the insulation.
Yeah, okay.
So, but that's so those are available out there. There's a podcasting platform that's been supporting the Thinking Fellows lately, which is called Radio Public. You might check them out. They're on the phone and they're web browsing supported. And then for Android, I've heard that the best option is called Podcast Addict. So if you have an Android device, you might check the show out there. All right, that's enough of just introductory matter. I think we can hop into the actual meat of the show. And so the title of your book is Killing Physicians, Shakespeare, and Blind Heroes.
Can we allow Dr. Norton to tell us a little bit about himself, perhaps?
Yes, that's
and
actually,
maybe our listeners would like to know who he is, too.
Yeah, that's probably good. That's probably good. I said you were a professor at Concordia, but
yes.
You're more than that. So,
well, thank you. Thank you for having me. This is
thank you for saying you're more than a professor.
This is an honor to be here. And it's a great show. I've heard some great great stuff come out of this podcast and appreciate you guys and the hard work you're putting in. It's fun to be here in San Clemente too. What a beautiful spot. This home is gorgeous and this space is fantastic. So yeah, I'm John Norton. Been at Concordia about 15 years now. I teach English there. I'm the English chair, writing chair, language chair.
It's a lot of chairs.
Part-time, I like to boss Adam Francisco around if I can. Look for ways to do that.
Good luck with that.
Remember that time?
Remember that time?
I've been married about 20 years now. I have 3 children, 16-year-old, 14-year-old, and a 5-year-old. And they keep me busy when I'm not at school. But Concordia's been a great place to work the last 15 years or so. Enjoy the student interaction, good colleagues. And this book has been an exciting new development over the last couple of years as I've taken it to print in this way. It's been cool. And a special thanks to you, Caleb, for kind of opening the door with 1517 for me, actually.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. For listeners, I think the other reason you've been mentioned on the show before is during the end of my junior year and my senior year, I was your TA, which was great because you actually helped me move from one of the other jobs I was doing on campus that I didn't want to do anymore to doing that, which was great. And I got to actually get some more kind of like classroom experience sitting in on your lectures and things like
that. You were great. You were great. The only problem with having you there now is I feel this big void now that I've...
Oh, bro.
It's Is that too affectionate?
Don't inflate his ego anymore.
No, yeah. Adam and I know his head barely fits through the door as it is. It's so good.
Oh man, that's funny. No, Caleb was really good. I'm gonna just go for it. I don't mind bolstering your ego a little bit, brother. Caleb was a fantastic student for me, and then I asked him to come and do some help in the English department for me, and did a great job proctoring exams, helping with writing workshops, even gave a couple lectures that I set up for you, and led some discussions and did some good stuff. So, talented young man.
So our listeners are probably sick of hearing me talk about that class that I taught at Concordia, the freshman intro class and the honors, where the students did the project.
That's right.
You know, where they had to go do something, shop build class. Something, milk something, shop classes, soulcraft.
Yeah.
Dr. Norton taught that class with me. We each had a section of the class. So. In the honors, whatever it was.
Honors section, yeah. It was honor students.
Yeah, great.
You know what's cool about that? One of the students I had in that class took that whole shop class to heart, learned how to cut hair.
Oh, that's cool.
one of the young men, and has clients every week now. And just last week, I got a haircut from him. So it was kind of full circle.
Oh, that is cool.
That's really neat.
You can tell how good I look.
Yeah,
that's great.
A credit to...
You are the poster child for Concordia's advertisements, right?
This young scholar, Adam, took it to heart. So now he's got a little business on campus. And
wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's really great. And then you and Dr. Francisco teach core together. Sometimes you guys have pairings, right? That's how I had both of you. So for the way the core works at Concordia, there's a history and a literature class paired together. And then I had Dr. Francisco for history, and then you for lit for two semesters. So that was actually...
Really? I didn't know you had me.
Oh, my Lord.
That's a while ago.
That's the juxtaposition. The deflating.
Dr. Norton, you're the best student I've ever had. Adam, wait a minute. You were in my class?
That's just an issue with my memory.
Oh. Yeah.
Didn't make as much of an impression on Adam.
Apparently not.
He was checked out. So
I just see him all the time, so it's...
It's all blur. But yeah, so after I was done, we met at the beginning or the end of class one day, and you were talking about publishing this book with a other publishing house, and I said,
not to be mentioned.
Yeah, and I said, no. You should publish that with us, and here we are. And this book came out in January as part of our catalog. So I think it was probably the first or second book in January of our 2018 catalog. And you're using it to teach a class and things like that too.
Yep.
But I was reading the intro here, and what struck me is that this book seems to be where you take the cross between Reformation theology and Shakespeare is kind of human anthropology and how Shakespeare explores that. And so I think we could maybe talk about that and see how that develops through the rest of your book. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Am I striking the right kind of
anthropology is an interesting way to put that. I've always thought there's more of a theological approach or a theological understanding of what a man is. And that's what really kind of caught me early on with Shakespeare's plays is the way he deals with the nature of man. And it was Hamlet was the first play that I saw this in. And it was this fascinating angst in Hamlet that he had to make his mother understand the situation, and you know, the situation there in Denmark at the time, right, was that he wanted her to see that she was in the wrong, that she had, unbeknownst to her, and she kind of blinded A.C. Crispin calls Gertrude a sheep in the sun, that just kind of blind and kind of wandering around, but he wants to make her understand that she has married the murderer of her husband, and she has no idea. So she's blind to herself. And so Hamlet's kind of insistence that she understand what she is and who she is really kind of caught my eye as someone who has read quite a bit of Reformation writing and theology and so forth. This idea of the mirror as the second most important rule of law, or the important rule, is it the second most important?
Or second use of the law. Or the primary use of the law, right. The mirror, just see your sin.
Yeah, absolutely. See your sin. And so this idea caught my eye because he uses a mirror. He says, I want to hold this mirror up to you. I want to show you the black and granite spots of your soul. I want to show you what a sinner you are, how broken you are, how desperate you are, how in error and sinful you are. And that just caught me as an interesting kind of shift in Shakespeare and in thought, away from kind of this Catholic view of self as being very capable of saving oneself. And so anyway, that to me is a theological kind of turn, I suppose, that you see in Shakespeare that you don't see as much in other Renaissance writing or writing before this.
Yeah, that's the reason I used the word anthropology is because on the show we've explored a couple times that there's a unique way that Christians view the world that is everybody is inherently sinful since the fall, right? That is part of who we are. And that's juxtaposed against those who would think that humanity is naturally good, right? And that there's just some evil there. And you seem to be exploring that through Shakespeare, that there is an evil that needs to be exposed.
Do you think that that's prevalent in all and or most of Shakespeare's work, that the driving force or function is to really reveal a certain depravity in man?
Definitely. I mean, that's something that I see, at least in the late plays and in the major tragedies, is understanding. How do we come to a place of understanding?
Yeah, I mean, that'd be very valuable. I mean, I think Caleb and I were just talking about this, I think probably last night, that one of the biggest cultural challenges I think Christians have right now, maybe even apologetically, is this very prevalent idea that all people are good, and with the application enough of their own independent goodness or sort of maybe even global goodness on the part of like science or
government
or technology or governments, that we can really overcome our biggest problems like war, evil, death, that type of thing. And it's a difficult challenge for the Christian apologetically, because your first step is sort of backed up. You're not even just talking about, you know, your need for a savior anymore. You're taking that into what we call left-hand kingdom issues and saying, listen, you actually are naive enough. Well, you may not say it that way in your conversation with somebody, but naive enough.
You would.
To look through history and see only, you know, good movements of man's heart resulting in good things rather than the reality, which is, in a lot of ways, the smarter we've gotten, the more evil we've been able to figure out how to perpetrate on one another. And while life has been extended, you know, it's only those who are naive that think that we can sort of, you know, that it'll be extended indefinitely.
Yeah, I mean, that's what a major theme I see in right now in culture is that all death is preventable.
Yeah.
Every single one. And it just seems, I think it's a hard boundary to overcome.
Yeah, maybe Shakespeare could help.
I think so. I mean, that becomes the turning point of each of these plays, the ones that I analyze especially, right? The major tragedies, except for Macbeth, and there's this pervasive darkness in Macbeth. And so there's a whole other study with Macbeth. The complete absence of humiliation or clarity is, I think, noteworthy in Macbeth, but that's a different book to write. Thanks for offering to publish that, by the way. That's great. the ones I look at, the major tragedies outside of Macbeth and the late plays, all have this major turning point that happens when a character finally recognizes that they are shameful, they haven't seen, that they've lacked vision, that they are not progressing upward in this way, right? That their life has not been this long road of getting better and better and better, but rather,
Probably the opposite.
Perhaps just the opposite for many of them. Yeah, for many of them. That their life has actually been spiraling downward and they have no idea. And so that to me is one of the most exciting things about what Shakespeare is seeming to accomplish, among many other things, right? That's why Shakespeare is so great. He's accomplished so much in these plays. But one of the major things is this picture of man as one who can only see once he sees himself, right? I was pretty excited at the beginning of this research when I found just the opening pages of Calvin's Institutes, where he talks about the knowledge of self is contingent upon the knowledge of God, and the knowledge of God is contingent upon the knowledge of self, right? And there's, to me, that Shakespeare had to have heard this, perhaps from a Richard Hooker sermon in London, perhaps. But this knowledge of self is kind of the opening. This knowledge of God is contingent upon knowledge of self, and knowledge of self is contingent upon knowledge of God. That this understanding of self, clear understanding, opens up the doors for these characters. Now, some of them succeed after having this open eye. Some of them die, and it's only their last moments of death that they actually see these things. But either way, I've got some pushback on this theory, because some say, well, Othello still dies, so what's the good of your theory? My point is that even though he dies, he still achieves this thing that's beyond himself, which is true vision and clarity. People are trying to call in already.
I know.
I love it.
It's killing
the lines are lighting up.
That's right.
I don't know what I said, but maybe it's something you said, Adam.
I was thinking that statement you made, that knowledge of who you are, who you really are, is necessary to see things aright, or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. It's almost like you're saying, and I mean, this won't come as a surprise, but once you finally own up to the world of facts and like how things really are and stop living in the world of abstraction and dreams and fairy tales and unicorns and all the rest of, that's when you, once you come to terms with just how, maybe not how rotten you are, but just what your life consists of and how what your shortcomings are, your habits and so on. And you kind of own that. Mm-hmm. It makes dealing with the real world rather than the world of abstraction a little easier, perhaps.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
Well, I think Shakespeare tackles that. I mean, King Lear is all about government and politics and bad leadership, right? He starts out, and you can tell things have not been going well the way the play starts, he says. He wants to express his darker purpose, and he wants to get everybody in a room together, and he's this typical politician. Sorry to sound jaded, but he's this politician who says he wants to get his daughters around, and he says, look, I'm going to divide up the kingdom, and I'm going to do this between the three of you daughters based on how much you tell me you love me. There's this beautiful picture of our politicians. I think we've been talking about our politicians today. I don't know. It seems that he's pointing right at Washington. And so clearly, and as I teach this text and write about it in the book as well, you know that things have not been going well in England, right? In Britain. How could it go well under a guy like this, right? And so the idea that he's living in this place of fantasy, right? That I'm going to rule this kingdom based on flattery, right, based on this exalted view of self, you know it's going to end miserably. And so he has a false sense of self, false sense of others, and all this ends up being this kind of miserable toxin to the kingdom itself. And so, as you can imagine, so he goes through this they call it the love test at the beginning of King Lear. And his first daughter, Goneril, I can't remember who goes first, Goneril or Regan, but they both basically say, you're the best, you're so handsome, Dad. If only our husbands were as handsome as you, and all the rest of this nonsense, right? And then his third daughter, Cordelia, and the whole time you see her, right, Shakespeare gives you some glimpses into what she's doing. She's kind of cringing in the corner saying, how can I heave my stomach or my heart into my mouth? What is this all about? This is the most ridiculous thing ever and I could possibly think of doing and so forth. And she seems to know that this kind of behavior has only led her dad into this dark place, this place of confusion. Why? Because all he's really concerned about is this kind of fantasy he wants to continue to grow, build around himself, which has led him to this place of really destroying the kingdom. He's going to, as he says, crawl unburdened toward death. He has his condo in Palm Desert all hooked up, and he's going to go and retire down there and turn the kingdom over to his daughter. So he's abdicating, right? So again, it would point to, Shakespeare would be pointing to a man who's clearly out of his wits for many different reasons, and I think you can extrapolate out and say a big point of that is failure to see himself and living in this fantasy world of people flattering him and having this delusional idea about the kingdom, about politics, about leadership, about authority, you name it, that has led to this horrifying place.
Yeah, to impose some Lutheran language here, or maybe Scott's bailiwick, the stuff Scott's really good at with vocation. You know, King Lear, he's shirked from his basic obligations and preferred a life of
unburdened
abstraction and fairy tales, and it all falls apart. And, you know, this is not a theological point, but you think about it at your home. You have obligations, depending on, you know, if you're married and you have children, you got all these obligations. If you shirk from those obligations, eventually, you know, it might not happen the first time, but eventually it just, things will
unravel,
spiral out of control.
Yes.
Perhaps that's I don't know. Is that a theological point?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's the answer sometimes that the reformers would give to the critics who would say, "Well, if we teach this justification by grace through faith alone, society's going to fall into chaos."
Yeah.
And I mean, the two part answer to that is, well, not if people see it as their calling to serve their neighbors freely, you know, starting again with those people closest to them and working outwards. And also, the application of salvation by grace through faith to the individual sinner does not obfuscate, you know, their duties in this world, nor does it obfuscate the fact that they will be punished civilly for and sometimes, you know, those punishments are intentional on the part of authorities, and sometimes they're just natural consequence. I say this all the time when I'm doing Be Dad with children, you know, that the application of grace to your children does not change the fact that they will face consequences in this world for bad behavior. The law is still the law, right? And sometimes those consequences will come at the hand of an authority, myself, my wife, a teacher, a policeman, something like that. And sometimes they're just natural. Like your world, when you ignore all of your duties in this life, your world falls apart. You know, your wife leaves, your dog dies because you haven't fed it, you know, whatever. It's like a, as they say, country music song played backwards. you know, so yeah, that's, I guess that's part of that. I love to hear, because I'm not a big Shakespeare, I mean, what I know of Shakespeare is I've been to Stratford-upon-Avon twice.
Nice.
And walked through his house. So
that's nice. Nice little walk, huh?
That's my the extent of my knowledge here. But I love hearing that this struggle that we struggle with today as Christians was a has always very much been a reality. There's nothing new under the sun here. And that it's been addressed in multiple ways and through multiple arenas, and that literature is one of them. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just to dovetail in what you're saying there in terms of vocation, Shakespeare loves to talk about authority in his plays, an authority that must be respected, authority that is part of vocation. And even in, if you look at the Henriad, the second tetralogy that Shakespeare writes is the one that ends with Henry V, you know, the famous St. Crispin's Day speech, right? That's Henry V. Hal, he's known as in Henry IV. But his father, Henry IV, is in angst for the first two plays of that tetralogy. He is in angst because he has deposed the former king. He has stepped out of his vocational role to take another man's role.
Yeah,
and he suffers under that. And he suffers under the really the torture kind of in his mind, the torture kind of in his conscience. That did he do the right thing? And it can we reject or subvert or overtake someone else's vocation in that way? Can you step out of that without facing some serious consequences? But there's that play, and there's several others that deal with this. I mean, I would say even Macbeth, you could talk about that with, as he takes the crown away from King Duncan in Macbeth, right? Macbeth starts in a fascinating way with Macbeth on the heath after some serious military victories. He's strung up some bodies and cut off some heads and done some fantastic things out on the heath there in the Civil War. And he comes back to his kind of headquarters, and he sees these three weird sisters, he calls them, and they're dancing around a fire of some sort, a cauldron, whatever. There's like children's fingers and some other kind of grotesque things in there. And they say to him, right, among other things, they say, "You're going to be the king." And he gets all pumped up, right? And he believes it, face value. He doesn't, again, idea of authority and vocation. He doesn't think about where he is and what his station is. All he thinks about is the next possible thing. Okay, I'm going to be king? Oh, I'm going to go after this. And that really becomes his unraveling, right? This rejection in some ways of this failure to see himself as for what he is and where what station he's in, and this kind of clamoring, this clawing and scratching after this role as king. And that doesn't end well for him, for many other people in the play, right? Ends in bloody torture and death. But there's a lot in Shakespeare about this idea, again, vocation. That'll be a fascinating study as well.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I would say that in our day and age, one of the biggest issues we face in Christianity with the idea of vocation is that it's not enough, right? That your service to your neighbor, which God, you know, recognizes on account of Christ as service to him, your service to your wife, your service to your children, to your coworkers, to your students, whatever, that it's not enough, and that we then have to go do something else that more special than that,
right?
You know, be it a mission trip or whatever.
Yep.
It's really, you come across, especially I'd say at the university, you come across a lot of young adults who are chasing after the next, you know, not the now. You know, I'm thinking Star Wars here. Never your mind on where you are. But
They want to change the world, right?
Well, yeah.
But they can't even be bothered to do the dishes.
Right. And that's that Ferdy quote that I read all the time, right? When he says, and when I tell my students that if they want to do something to serve God, that their first step is to be better students.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, they're deflated. They don't like to hear that, yeah. You know, and...
Maybe the best first step is to put down the smartphone when you're driving down the freeway.
Yeah.
I mean, real simple things that you can do to serve your neighbor.
Save some lives.
Yeah. That'll change a lot of people's world.
Yeah. But everybody wants to be king. And so if three weird sisters come along and tell you that you're right, your vocation here is kind of miserable and lame, guess what? You're going to be king. I think everybody is going to go, heck yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's the nature of the mind. That's the nature of sin. That's the nature of the mind to point in that direction.
That's great. You know what's funny about that? Like that line that I love, even the way you phrased it is good. Macbeth's with his buddy Banquo, and they've been fighting together and battling and doing all kinds of great heroics together as soldiers, right? As they're filling their role and their vocation, and they really, the king honors them for this, right? And so Banquo is with Macbeth as they come up to these weird sisters, and while Macbeth is just completely overtaken, right, by the narrative of these weird sisters and thinks, oh, this is awesome. Why wouldn't I believe it? Mm-hmm. Banquo's sitting behind him saying, are you seeing what I'm seeing? I mean, these are freaky looking ladies here. And I don't even know if they are ladies. They may be some other kind of creature. Yeah. And second of all, do you know, he says, and I don't quote this directly, but he basically says, often the enemy of this world uses half-truths to pull us into these kind of dangerous ways of seeing self, which to this kind of idea, you know, we are made in the image of God. We are made for greatness, right?
Right.
And that is true. But to see that and to see greatness in the way that the world sees it versus the way that God sees it is to make this grave error.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, that Macbeth is kind of caught up in that, right? He's caught up in this, the weird sister's view of greatness is to be king. That's really all the greatness you can achieve. But he doesn't see outside that.
Yeah, well, that's what the father of lies does, right? Jim Nestigan is fond of saying that the first sin was to convince Eve to trust her own memory instead of God's word. And you could say it this way, you know, the sin that the devil can always count on us committing is to trust the story we'd like to tell rather than the one that God has already spoken for us. And the story we'd like to tell always glorifies us and never, you know, gives glory to God alone. But the story that he's already told, that, you know, we're a player in by his grace and on account of Christ. Right. The story he's already told is a story of his glory and our salvation on account of Christ. And that's what the devil always does. He comes in and whispers in your ear to tell your own story. That's why I think a lot of this, we're getting very cultural on this, but this a lot of this sort of, and, you know, sometimes I never name the university by name here, but at the university you even see, advertising to future students that'll say things like, tell your own story and things like that. And I think it's done...
Find your voice.
Yeah, it's done harmlessly in a sense, right? You know, and right. I don't blame the copywriters who are just using vernacular language to try to get people to pay $40,000 a year for a degree, but... it's thoughtless in the sense that, you know, that's dangerous stuff. You know, when I think that I'm the dictator of my own tale, you know, that's a dangerous mentality, not just theologically, but for their own future. That's just not real.
Yeah.
Just not real. And
no, it's not.
Sometimes you need the guy sitting behind you going, are you seeing what I'm seeing here?
Exactly. You know, that are you guys familiar with T.S. Eliot's Tradition and the Individual Talent? Probably one of the best essays I've ever read.
Probably Adam is, but I'm...
Do you know that one?
Nope.
Oh, man.
I'm a heathen on these things.
No, but he starts it out, along the similar line, though, he starts it out talking about what it is to be great, what it is to be great. And he says, people think to be great is to be different. And you talk about finding your own voice, because that will be so individual, right? Your voice. And then you'll be great. Once you find out what your little heartbeat will say, T.S. Eliot comes against that. And he says, you know what it is to be great? And I think this is where you're going with this idea. At the university proper, right? At the university that we dream of seeing and supporting, at that university, you become connected to the great voices, the great
of the past.
Ancient voices of the past.
Yeah.
And that's T.S. Eliot's point. He says to be truly a great poet is not to be different or unique or to find your little niche because of your little heartbeat and the way that works, but rather is to find and to connect yourself to these great voices of antiquity, which I think is phenomenal. And he says the greatest poets are the ones who do that the best, who find that connection in this voice of antiquity and so forth, and the voices of antiquity, right, who are connected to this great stream, as opposed to having your own little tributary you call your own name.
Right? Yeah.
There's a French political philosopher. I know we got to take a break here in a second.
Well, who wrote actually, since we're doing the book, we'll just roll in with this. I'll talk about the book at the store. So, yeah.
Well, the French political philosopher wrote, there's never so dangerous of people who have no history.
Ooh.
You know, who see themselves dislodged or disconnected from the past.
Yeah.
Because they're untethered, you know. They could go in a good direction.
Possibly.
Maybe.
Perhaps. But there's nothing that would keep them from perpetrating grave evils. And I think that's kind of like in the level of poetry with T.S. Eliot.
T.S. Eliot, yeah, exactly.
That's not dissimilar from Lewis's idea of chronological snobbery. In that, you know, he's looking at it from the perspective of it's not that we don't have a history, but we think it's useless because we think we're so advanced now that we only look upon and cogitate upon our own ideas now, because of course they're so much more advanced because we're so much more advanced than the people of the past. Why would we why would we think that there's value there or that they were smarter than us or any of that? And in his life, of course, that was, you know, very dangerous for him, both in his as we were speaking before, his spiritual life, how it played out, you know, to his salvation, but also in his day-to-day life, in his vocations to serve his family, to serve one another, to serve the people that were in his lives. It was very dangerous for him. It was not productive.
And so what is that? That to me is the blinding nature of pride, right? And so we tell students, we cater to their... And by we, I mean some other university somewhere else, professors very unlike us here, who cater to students' desire to, feel good about themselves.
Right.
So we say, you got to find your voice, because your voice, man, once people start hearing your voice, you'd be on a microphone with some really fancy...
Yeah, the world would be so much different
Everybody would be so happy once you start singing those songs and so forth. The problem with that... I think we see this played out in different plays as well, but I'm thinking of The Winter's Tale. Shakespeare's one of his late plays called The Winter's Tale. There's this king who really can only see things from his perspective. And that, again, that's a common idea in Shakespeare, right? This idea of blindness that is created by pride. Without this proper and reforming and sharpening humiliation, we have characters who kind of walk around blinded by their own pride. So this guy... he's certain that his wife is cheating on him. And the play starts out with he and his best friend, actually, this guy Polixenes. And his wife is 9 months pregnant. Polixenes has been in the kingdom for 9 months. It's a little bit of a...
Quinkening
there, perhaps, right? So this becomes a big kind of coincidence in his mind, right? He kind of just blows this idea up. He's been here 9 months. She's 9 months
pregnant. We've been getting sparkless water for 9 months. My wife's 9 months pregnant.
And he looks at them and he says he sees them just talking, and somehow his mind blows up and he gets in this rage of jealousy, and all he can see is his perspective.
I mean, of course he doesn't see that he's been there for 9 months too.
Exactly. And there's so many other things, right? But he's blinded by his own perspective. He's certain of himself, and although there's people all around him saying, "You are a fool," and people willing to die for this fact, right? They step in front of him, and he threatens their lives. But they continue, right? And they say, "No, you are a fool. She is faithful." And so, there's a man, again, convinced of his own news clippings, convinced of his own press and so forth. His pride has blinded him, and it takes this dramatic...
Convinced of others' sin.
But not his own.
But not his own.
His own, exactly. And again, it's just these pictures, again, in these plays where you have these characters who get caught up in this pride, in this false view of self. And sadly, I do think in our culture, we are playing upon that with students at times. We are playing upon that with each other. Our culture is trying to convince us of the fact that we have that special voice. It is you, the way you're seeing, your perspective. Never mind what anybody else thinks. Never mind what anybody else has ever read or written. Your perspective. You run with that because you never know, that could be great. as opposed to, no, I think you should humble yourself, connect yourself with these great voices of the ages, connect yourself with those around you who may see things more clearly, and then maybe you'll have a chance at really getting something to the truth or stepping toward the truth. So, yeah.
That's pretty good. It's, I mean, this episode, like you said, has been kind of cultural, maybe even a little political, but that's kind of the crossover when the rubber meets the road with these concepts, especially these theological concepts as we talk about in Lutheranism, especially the two kingdoms, how this actually plays out in two different ways for our lives and how we have to live in both kingdoms for this period of time. And so this has been a great episode. I do have a couple just questions. So why the title Killing Physicians?
Well, that's a good question.
Good.
Could have been a good question 45 minutes ago.
Start with the title.
Yeah.
Well, it fits. I mean, it fits where we're kind of going to. Killing Physicians, this is the Banquo figure, as I mentioned before, with Macbeth, who says, hey, you know, I think you may be in error here. I think you may be sick in your way of seeing things. Would you consider seeing things a different way? Because the way you're looking at this is clearly disease. Mm. But the actual Killing Physician quote comes from King Lear. There's a character named Kent who's fantastic. He's kind of cast in this plain dealer role. Kent says to Lear, you must see better. You must see better because your daughter, this Cordelia, who is not willing to flatter you, who is not willing to butter you up like the other two, is actually the one faithful daughter. He steps into this kind of argument, right? As King Lear is banishing Cordelia, Kent is the chief king's advisor. He comes in and he says, no. You're making a huge mistake. You're going to die. This is going to cost you. These unfaithful daughters will kill you. And so he says, step not between the dragon and his wrath. He says that to Kent, right? And Kent says, let thy sword fall, basically. Let your dagger fall. Kill thy physician, is what he says. Kill thy physician. That's what he says of himself, calling himself King Lear's physician, right? As the one who is willing to step in and say, you have a problem. Mm. And I base this on Luther's whole kind of metaphor of the doctor, right? Who says to the patient, you have an illness. And instead of the patient saying, thank you. And how do you suggest that I get well? Right? Which would be the humble posture. Instead, what does the patient say? And in Luther's metaphor, he says, how dare you?
Yeah.
You're the one that's sick.
Yeah.
How dare you affront me in this way? How dare you call me sick? How dare you? And all the while, the physician is saying, I'm just pointing out your grave illness. And the patient turns on him, right? In a fantastic way, Shakespeare plays this out with King Lear and Kent. And I think it's just an incredible kind of outworking illustration, if you will, of this doctrine that Luther points out through this physician-patient relationship, which is the gospel, right? Or the law, I suppose, it comes to us and says, look, you are sinful, you have this problem, you need a savior. And so instead of saying, oh yeah, yes, you're right. No, we reject that. We say, no, I don't need a savior. I'm good. My voice is beautiful. Haven't you heard it? My ideas are wonderful, albeit they're disconnected from
my
tradition.
Art drives us on.
That's
that, that was Nero.
Oh, my.
Or what exactly. What a artist the world is losing in me as he's dying.
Exactly.
It's a lot of this stuff that you're just talking about going on today in our culture.
Oh,
where somebody will point out. You know, we were talking over lunch about this guy, what is it, Jordan Peterson?
Jordan B. Peterson, yeah.
Calling out sort of the, you know, some of the weirdness with gender stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And or anybody, it could be anybody, and they're just automatically dismissed and called a racist, a transphobe, a homophobe, you know, whatever.
Right.
And I mean, that's another book for you.
That would be, I'll work on that. Thanks for offering to publish that.
Well, I was sitting there. I mean, Luther's metaphor with that, he's obviously talking about the fact that we did kill the physician.
Yes.
You know, the problem is he wasn't good at staying dead.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
Know? So that's great.
Yeah. That's great. So listeners who want to purchase the book, who are interested in this intersection of theology and literature, which is really cool because I think most of our classical literature is informed by some sort of theological position, typically in history, maybe modern literature, not so much because we've turned to some secular atheism, but
reaction against perhaps.
Yeah, but these classic works are informed by possibly net with Shakespeare, Reformation ideas, right? Mm. So if you want to read more about how this works out, you can go to Amazon.com. I'll have a link in the show notes for Killing Physicians there, as well as shop.1517legacy.com. I will have a link to it in our own store so you can buy it however you want. It comes in paperback, hardcover, and is a Kindle ebook if you prefer reading like that. What would you say the reading level is for this book? What's the target audience?
All ages. No, I'm kidding. Buy it for everyone you know. No. I would say upper high.
Buy copies for your friends. That's what I would say.
Dozens upon dozens. Everyone needs at least two copies. I'd say upper high school and beyond. Right?
Okay.
Upper high school and college level. It's not graduate school level. I mean, there's some great references in here. I think this can really kind of turn you on to some deeper study. But this is, I think in many ways, I've set it up as more of a primer. You know, as a way that I use this in my Shakespeare class at Concordia. And have students in the intro to Shakespeare class read this. Because it's a good kind of intro to each play, gives some historical background and some of these theological elements that are very complex in the era, right? Gives students, I like to say, a sense of kind of the air that Shakespeare was breathing, right, in London at the time. So,
Do you know if we're planning to put out, I think we are, an audio version of this?
I'll have to check out, but this may down the road be available as an audiobook as well. I think you could finish it in a weekend, right? It's about 110 pages, it looks like, which I think is most of the books we published at 1517. We try to do them so that, you know, lay level reading for these kind of subjects. And I don't know, I love this kind of thing, the presentation of Christian doctrine outside of where you would normally
I do too. I mean, this conversation grabbed me more than I thought it was going to. And the reason I asked about the audiobooks is because, as you know, I drive and or fly a lot.
That's right. True.
And while I could probably read a book on an airplane, driving and reading a book is problematic.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
That's great. Well, thank you for joining us on this episode. We might have you back when you publish that second book. Right?
Yes.
And then,
or the third one. Didn't you mention the third one as well? Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you, Adam, for funding that.
this has been a fun episode. It's the special topics have been great because right now
we love the show, special topics.
We've been doing one episode in each category that we have, and all of the special topics have been Q&A so far up until now in March. And I told listeners last week that this was going to be a Q&A episode, but then you ended up being free with spring break and everything, so we squeezed you in instead. So this is what we're doing for the month, and I don't know, I think this was a great start to the series we're going to do from people publishing books with 1517 as well. So.
So does that mean you're taking away our Q&A special episode from us? We love Q&A episodes.
Well, okay, maybe upon request I'll add another one this month.
All right.
All right, well, thank you for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.
Thank you, guys.